You're listening to episode 216 of Women Worldwide. I'd never heard of traumatic brain injury or TBI. My guest today shares the heart-wrenching story of her husband's brain injury, how their lives changed instantly one morning, and how she was thrust into the role of caregiver. Stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Women Worldwide. Today's topic is something that we've never covered before on the show, so I'm really excited to introduce our special guest. But first, here's a Women Worldwide update. We're at 1.95 million downloads. Okay, so 2 million is right around the corner. We're going to be there before you know it. And it's because all of you who are tuning in, your active listeners, sharers, and supporters, we see you out there on social media, amplifying the voices of our guests who come on the show. And you're really helping to help them make a difference and to grow the Women Worldwide Network. So I want to thank you, and my entire Women Worldwide team thanks you as well. Now let's get to today's topic, the role of the caregiver. Donna O'Donnell Figurski joins me on the show today. Donna has just published a book called Prisoners Without Barriers, A Caregiver's Tale, which is a memoir. And it's the story of her husband, David, who suffered traumatic brain injury. David survived 3 brain surgeries and defeated what Donna refers to as desperate odds, and probably what the doctors shared with her as well. Donna was there the whole time by his side, suddenly thrust into the role of being her husband's caregiver. This is a story, and I'm reading the book now, almost finished with it. It's a story of love and hope at a time that was what appears to be and was terrifying, and presented new challenges to Donna and David every single day. And I'm going to stop here because it's probably best for Donna to share her journey with you. Donna, it's great to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thanks, Deirdre. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we are certainly very happy to have you here. I have your book in my hands, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. And I really remember at the beginning of the book, a part where you were talking about how everything was normal. It was almost life was normal until it suddenly wasn't. Can you share what led up to David's traumatic brain injury and almost your path to caregiving?
Well, with brain injury, with almost any brain injury, it's usually an instant thing, something very, very unexpected that you're not expecting to happen. I had never heard of brain injury prior to having David have his. So yeah, life was normal. We were, David was working his job, I was working mine. We were both empty nesters. And this one particular morning on January 13th in 2005, David was doing his typical exercises. He did 12 chin-ups every other day. He did a whole series of Tai Chi. And he got up usually at 4 o'clock so he could be at his laboratory at Columbia University by 6. This particular morning, he was working at home. So that was very fortunate. And so at that particular time, instead of doing 12 chin-ups, he did 13. And 13 was the dreaded number, the hated number right now. And that's what happened, something burst inside his head at that point. And he came into the bedroom with me. I happened to still be home. And he had his hand covering his eye and just said that he was in excruciating pain in his head. So, the first thing I was thinking, do we need to get the ambulance? Do we need to get to the doctor? And he thought, no, let's just wait a bit. And he was explaining everything to me. I was trying to follow what was happening because I figured I was going to have to tell somebody at some point, some doctor. So, but eventually it got to the point where the pain was so bad, he could feel it just rising through his head. And he tells me later that he could actually feel the blood leaking up there. So we ended up, I did call the paramedics, and we did get him into the hospital right away. And the surgeon met me and said, well, if we do another CAT scan, he had had one CAT scan, it was determined that he had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is a bleed. And whenever you have a bleed in your brain, you're killing off the neurons in the brain. And you don't want to do that. That's really, really dangerous. They do not, they don't easily heal back, or, if they're killed off, they're gone. So basically, David, I was given very, very little chance of his surviving an operation, but it was a 1 in 600 chance if he went and did an extra CAT scan to see if the blood was receding. It was going to be a 1 in 20 chance of his survival if he went into surgery immediately. So I did sign on the dotted line to have him have the surgery, but it was probably the most scary thing I've ever done in my life. So that's what, so that moment he had his brain injury, instantly turned me into a caregiver, unknowing that that's what my new role was going to be.
That is a frightening story. And if you, do you ever think about, and I think you did mention it in the book, if you weren't there, like, this could have been a completely different scenario. What happens if David was alone? What happens if he was at his lab at Columbia and he didn't quickly have you to be thinking, oh, maybe we should call the paramedics, and waited too long?
Right.
Then what?
Well, there wouldn't have been a book for sure, because David wouldn't have made it. I really, truly don't believe he would have survived had he had I not been there, and had we not gotten him to the hospital as quickly as possible. Had he not been home himself, he should have been in his laboratory, and his graduate students and his postdoctoral scientists probably wouldn't have been there that early. They work very odd times of the day and night. So it's likely that nobody would have been there that early in the morning. So yes, he would have been home, or it could have happened on the way to his lab, So, there are a lot of what ifs, and we'll never know what those, what the repercussions of those would be. But I just feel
kind of glad not to know.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Yeah, I'm just glad that I was still home. I was going to leave in 10 minutes, and he was home working on a talk he was going to give at Wesleyan College, Wesleyan University that Saturday. So fortunately, all those things came into place. Unfortunately, he had the brain injury to begin with, but,
Yes. And so the 1 in 20 chance, opting for the surgery, mm-hmm. David goes through the surgery. I can only imagine what that was like, that wait, how you were feeling, what was going on in your mind. But at that point, did you realize you were going to be a caregiver? Or at what point did you realize, and did you feel equipped to be that person? Did you even know what the role was going to be like?
No, Deirdre, not at all. And in fact, I think it took me many years before somebody actually pointed out to me that I was a caregiver. I just simply continued on with life the way it was presented to us at that time. Obviously, David had his brain injury. He had three brain surgeries within 2 weeks. And because every time they'd go in, they'd find something else that they had to do. So he had a surgery for the original, the subarachnoid hemorrhage, where they found in, when I had him transferred to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, then
I remember that in the book. Yep.
An aneurysm that had to be taken care of. So that was a week later. When they came back from that surgery, they said there was an AVM, which is an arterial venous malformation. And that is another dangerous tangle of blood vessels that can burst. So he had some major stuff going on in his brain. And when he was there, I mean, I just knew I was going to be caring for him, but I didn't think of anything more than, you know, we're going home and I'm his wife and I'll do what I have to do. It never really crossed my mind about caregiver until probably well after I wrote the book. I mean, because the absolute title, The Caregiver's Tale, came in at the very end. You know, and an agent who had read the book said, you know, this book is about you. This is a story about David, but it's through your eyes as the caregiver. You know, and I was like, I didn't see it that way, but I definitely see it that way now. And yes, I am his 24/7 caregiver. It's a lot easier now, 14 years later, than it was in the beginning, because he was totally incapacitated in all physical ways. He was not able to dress himself, feed himself, get to the bathroom on time. I had to get him from a chair to wheelchair to move him from chair to bed, you know, wheelchair to bed. I mean, it was everything at that point.
Yeah, didn't somebody actually teach you the best way to move him from bed to wheelchair? Because that was hard.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yes, it was. That was one of the last things they taught me in therapy during David's therapy in at the rehab hospital, because they knew I had to be able to pick him up and do it. And you can't just pick somebody up. And he was dead weight, even though he had lost 30 pounds in the hospital and was only coming in at like 128 pounds at that time. But 128 pounds is dead weight.
So 120,
you know, right. You know, for somebody. So yeah, I was taught how to do it. So I wouldn't hurt my back. And so yeah, I mean, you just do it.
You do it as you go along.
Yeah.
So the three surgeries, I mean, those alone, and this is a hurdles question, was it in the beginning and getting past those hurdles that were the toughest, or were there other larger hurdles, for example, when he went to the rehab facility or from the rehab facility to finally getting him home?
Well, hurdles for David, I don't think he was comprehending any of what was going on. So you could have probably given him 10 more surgeries and he wouldn't have had a clue. But but I don't know whether I could have lived through any more of those. But so, I mean, of course, each of David's surgeries were huge hurdles for me. So
right.
was putting in the trach. So was putting gastrointestinal peg into his stomach to feed him. Every day was a hurdle. So I mean, I can't pinpoint one. It's just they just kept coming. You think you finished one thing, and then there's another. Now he can't, you know, they're testing him for swallow disorder because they're going to take the trach out. But they realize that his swallow mechanism isn't working properly. So we're up doing video fluoroscopies to see how his swallow mechanism is working. And so, you know, then you're just sitting there hoping, okay, I hope this works. You know, and when it doesn't, then you just have to go back to the drawing board and wait until they do it again and hope again. So it was a lot of hope and a lot of carrots being held out.
So that the word hope, you know, I guess there, it sounds like you were able to find hope or little glimmers of happiness. You know, is that what you did? Is that what kept you moving through and sort of staying focused on the prize, which is David moving from hospital and surgeries to rehab to home, always taking new steps? Is that what gave you hope?
I think yes. And I never really believed that this was going to be forever. I mean, most of the time you have, you know, you get a broken arm, it gets fixed. Many people have cancer and eventually they can conquer that. So I never really thought it was going to be forever. And our doctor had said, one of the neurosurgeons at Columbia had said, he'll come back to probably about 95% of himself, which I didn't think was so great. But right now I'd be happy with 95% because I don't think he's reached that level. But, you know, and he doesn't either. But, you know, every time we went to his neurologist, he would always give us hope. And there was always that carrot, like maybe next time something's going to happen. Next time it's going to be better. I'm going to get different news. And so I never really gave up that way. And I think that was a fortunate because his vision doctor, his neurologist always gave us hope. They always said, let's try something else. Let's try this. And so that was our carrot. That was the little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel that we kept going towards.
There was one doctor, though, and I want to point this out in the very beginning, that didn't give you hope.
No.
The doctor that said, and I hate to say this, I think it was something to the effect of he would make a good organ donor. And that's really sad and scary, because if there were doctors like that around you the entire journey, it would change your perspective, and then that would change how you cared for David, and that might change how he progresses.
And I think you're exactly right there. But that is a true statement. That's how I met his first neurosurgeon. He met me at the in the waiting room and put his hand out and shook my hand and said, "Hi, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and your husband is in very good health. He'll make a great organ donor." And I was like, oh my gosh.
That's just,
you know,
and crushing.
That I know what means. He doesn't expect him to live. And I said, well, I just kind of said, well, I don't think David wants to be an organ donor. But I knew it was on his license. You know, so I was like, oh gosh. But at that point in my head, I was also thinking, he's not going to be in this hospital very long. I'm getting him out to go over to Columbia University. Not Columbia University, Columbia Presbyterian.
Columbia Presbyterian. Yeah. Well, good thinking
on
your part, having those instincts. And also having folks in, I guess, in David's network, in your network, that could help arrange that.
Yes.
Because it did happen, I think, fairly quickly.
Not as quickly as I would have liked, but yes, there were some heels being dragged. But but yes, it did happen. I called immediately to David's chairman of his department of molecular biology, and he immediately got the wheels turning so that David would be taken over there to Columbia Presbyterian. So I was very fortunate in those aspects too, that we had those connections, and that he was at one of the best hospitals in the country. So.
Yes, and that was a powerful moment in the book. As a reader, as David was leaving the one hospital to go to Columbia Presbyterian, and I think you were like waving goodbye to him almost, if I'm getting my sequence correct. And it was just, I guess, that thought of, is he going to make it through the ambulance ride to the hospital? Because I think the doctors at the first hospital pointed out that they didn't think that he would make it.
That's exactly true. The president of the hospital even called me.
Yes, that's right. President called you to try to get you to change your mind about the transport.
And so it was scary. It was a very scary thing because he was in such a precarious situation at this point. So, I actually, you know, I told him, I said, I appreciate your concern and everything, but this is David's home hospital. I mean, it's where he works. And so I really felt that it was important for him to be over there. And, you know, I think he called me twice, if I remember correctly. Whatever's in the book is correct, but now a few more years have passed and a little memory has gone out a little bit further away. But yeah, I mean, so they did not want him to leave, and it was scary, but I was assured by one of David's, she was a doctor who was actually doing a PhD work in David's lab. And she's the one that made all the connections. She assured me that she had the best ambulance drivers. And the ambulance drivers, when they came over to do the transfer, took forever to get him ready, because that's how much work they had to do to make sure he was hooked up to everything. And they said, "Donna, don't worry. We'll get him there, but just go home." It was the first time in 3 days I'd gone home. But go home, get freshened up, bring your stuff, and come back. You know, so meet us at the hospital.
How long were you, and I don't remember the time frame in the book, but just to give listeners an idea, from the time that David got to the first hospital, had the surgery, and then you transported him over to Columbia Presbyterian. How many, was that a week? Was that 2 weeks?
No. It was, he arrived in the morning of of January 13 in 2005. And then on Saturday, that was a Thursday. And then Saturday evening is when he was transferred over.
You know what's interesting, Donna, is that as a reader, you feel there's so many details and all the things that happened and how you had to call relatives and let them know, that it felt like it was a longer time, but it was actually a very short time to have him transported.
Yeah, no, I the moment I got to the hospital, well, I didn't call anybody right away.
No,
I just felt like
that.
Yeah, I thought I even asked the ambulance people if they could bring me home afterwards. I mean, how naive is that?
Yeah. Oh, that's so hopeful though.
Yeah. But I mean, it was just like, I had no idea what was going on. And, basically I just was very naive about this whole thing. So
that's
I didn't even call my children till much later. And the nurse in the emergency room had said, "Donna, have you called your children?" And I said, "No." And she said, "I think you better."
Oh,
and
she
that,
knew.
That clued me in right there that something was seriously wrong. I mean, I truly thought David was coming home that afternoon. I didn't realize the severity of it. You know,
right. You don't know what you don't know. This is all a new experience and heart wrenching at that. Donna, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts just for a moment. We're going to take a super quick break, give some love to our sponsor. And when we get back, Donna's going to share more about her journey with David and some of the things that went on for them as they progressed forward, and her caregiving tale.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Yesterday's techniques won't work. Today, you have an opportunity to expand your communications approach with fresh, creative, and effective ways to power up your brand voice through new channels and to interact with more value and meaning. Pure Performance Communications will work with you to move audiences from awareness to action and impact. You'll foster greater engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Let us help you uncover what's holding you back and help you to carve out a marketing PR roadmap to success. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with two M's.com. Now back to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge.
Welcome back to the show. Donna O'Donnell Figurski and I were chatting about Donna's book, Prisoners Without Bars, and her husband David's traumatic brain injury and what it's like to suddenly become a caregiver. So Donna, in the last segment, you talked about the three different surgeries. We touched upon the transport from one hospital to another, you know, not knowing certain things and how scary that must have been for you. What do you think, if you just look back on what happened with David and what you both experienced, what do you think you learned about yourself through all of this?
Well, I think what I definitely learned is that I'm much more capable than I ever thought I was. I'm more strong than I ever thought I was. I never really gave it much thought to think about that, those kind of things. But when you're put into a situation like this, you have to take charge. And in our lives before, David's in my life, you know, I was in charge of most of the, you know, the family type stuff, the cooking, the taking the errands and the cook, taking the children to, you know, soccer games, et cetera, doctor's appointments. So I had my jobs in the family and David had his. And I never went into his. So it was a big, huge learning curve. And I realize now that I can do that. Not necessarily do I like to do it, but I can do it. And I had to do it because he couldn't. So that encompasses paying the bills.
I was just going to ask, what were some of his jobs?
Yeah, he would always take care of paying the bills. And I knew nothing about that. I had my cousin who was down the street was coaching me on, you know, he'd bring my mail over to him and he said, throw it out. And I couldn't, you know, all those little advertisements you get from the Visa credit cards. Yep. I had to go through them and read every single word to make sure I wasn't doing something wrong. So that was one thing I know where those now they go in without even being opened into the trash at this point or the recycling.
Right.
So
that's an automatic.
Yeah. But at the time I didn't know. I sometimes paid bills twice because I didn't understand it. And David had some online, you know, bill payer type things.
Oh,
and
right.
Somewhere I had to write checks. So I was totally confused. I didn't know how to use an ATM machine. And again, that's not David's fault. That's mine. Because he would right. take me to use the ATM machine and show me the PIN, and I would ignore it. So those are the kinds of things that, I mean, I just figured David was my ATM. I would put my hand out and $20 would land in it, you know, and I'd be fine.
Yes. Yeah, so, and that was normal.
Life was
normal.
And I still like that kind of life.
But I would like to ask for money and just have it magically appear.
No, really.
That's awesome.
It was really great. But but I refused to learn all those things.
Right.
And so when David went into a coma and when he was unavailable to do any of this, I had to step up. I had to learn all that stuff. And now to this day, I take care of all that business. In fact, yesterday I spent the day doing the taxes, which is something I never would have done. But I have had to, you know, and not actually doing them because we'll take it to the accountant, but just gathering all the stuff is horrendous.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I think those are some of the things that I learned about me during this time.
That's really important lessons.
And I think we actually, I'm going to just expound on that a little bit because I think it's really important for others to know your partner's job. Mm-hmm. Know, so you can take over in a blink if you have to. So you don't get stuck into a situation like I was in. It was not comfortable.
That's great advice. It's true. It helps no matter what happens to either party. And then hopefully it's not a traumatic brain injury, but even if there's a death in the family and one spouse has to tend or be a caregiver to somebody else, you just don't know.
Exactly.
So you can always be picking up for one another. You mentioned in the last segment about the nursing, it was time, you know, when are you going to let your children know? In the book, your children were there. There were other relatives who came. There were members of David's Columbia community that were there. I'm sure you had friends and colleagues as well. So I guess, how did you, or who did you rely on the most for help and comfort? And were you able to accept help from others right away?
That's interesting. In the beginning, when all this was happening, I really was, I mean, I did accept the help from all the family members because they did fly in from all over the United States. Once I called my daughter and my son and my cousin, then they took care, and my brother actually too. So those were all the points where the grapevine started. And then everybody started to either contact me or start making their flights to come in. So there were a lot of people, David's brothers and his father and their families all came in that day. My son and my daughter came in that day. My cousin who lived right down the street from me was in Florida and she flew back.
Is that Patty?
Yes.
Patty? Yeah, Patty.
Yeah. And she flew back immediately. Her husband was with me during the when David got out of surgery. He came out of his job in New York City and was there, as well as my teaching assistant, who left our classroom and came down to stay with me for that day. So, I mean, those are the people that I relied on. But you know what? In the very, very beginning, this is kind of unique. It was the nurses and the staff there and the receptionist in the office that she took care of me for that first, while David was still in the emergency room and before the doctor came. She had me behind her desk sitting chatting with her.
I was going to point that out.
Yeah.
That she sort of took you in and to have you sit with her.
Right.
That probably was very comforting.
It was. I just am so grateful to her and to the emergency room nurse too, because, I mean, they all came up when David got out of surgery. He was in the recovery room. They all came up in mass and said in the emergency room, doctor wanted to, but he was with another patient, to see how David was doing, because they had heard that he lived and nobody expected it.
Nobody expected it.
Yeah. So that was a really good support system for that particular day. And then, of course, my daughter and my son remained for a couple of weeks. So that was good. Now, once everybody goes back home, then you're pretty much on your own. It's just kind of because, you know, everybody does go back to his or her own lives.
Does that get harder on you? Is that a time that you actually need more help?
Probably, yes. But that's where I started doing the email updates that ended up being the fodder for this book. But, you know, so I would be writing to people because they would always write to me. So I was still getting emails from everybody in the beginning. And then, of course, as the year goes on, then everything, you know, eases off because everybody's back in their own normal lives again. And then it's just, you know, David and I who are, you know, wading through this mire.
Right. And people were helping David too. In the book, you mentioned that his colleagues were working with his students. And there was also somebody who was sort of keeping his lab.
Right. There were several professors that were overseeing David's lab while he was in Columbia and in the rehab. Actually, until he returned to his lab. I think it was September 06, he actually returned to his laboratory full time and on salary. Prior to that, he went in as a volunteer in his own lab. And, but even though he was in, once he got to rehab, several weeks into rehab, so maybe a month or so into rehab, he was able to have his students come over. They would, you know, visit him in mass, like maybe four or five of them, and he would tell them what to do on their research.
Oh.
So his cognitive brain was perfectly fine, and we're so grateful for that. It was his physical disabilities that caused the problem. Then we had some professor friends who stepped up and drove him to work, and that is a huge ordeal, because everybody when you live in a you know, New York suburbs like this, everybody's so spread out. So one of the drivers was taking 10 miles out of his way every day to come out. And another one is at least 5 or 6 miles to pick David up and take him in. So that, you know, so he did have that support.
Do you think that support changed the course or helped David to progress in a better way, having the purpose of the lab, having the students who needed him even when he wasn't back in the lab yet and he was talking to them? What role did that play?
Well, I think it played a very big role. I mean, I think that helped his self-esteem, and David thought he was okay, you know, because he was still doing this. I think he was kind of oblivious to a lot of things going on around him. But I think that was really important for him to do that. But there was one professor, and he was from the University of Louisville, who has been a lifelong friend of ours. And he invited David out to Estes Park, Colorado, for the 50th Wind River Conference on microbiology.
Oh.
And he invited David to be the keynote speaker.
Wow.
And David did that in the summer, June of 2006. So it's only a year and a half after. And I truly credit Olga Stripes for giving David back his scientific life.
That's wonderful.
You know, he, as well as I'm not disregarding the other, you know, professors at Columbia,
sure.
Because there were two professors that were, I mean, several of them actually were over visiting David in New Jersey so often. And some of them had tears in their eyes when they visited him. He was that way. Well, like,
and this was in rehab.
That was both, it was both in rehab and at Columbia Presbyterian. I mean, grown men, these great big huge men, yeah. With tears in their eyes, well, because they see David as this little limp rag in the bed, you know, doing nothing.
Sure.
Yeah, so.
Well, it's wonderful the way that people would visit, how they would help as you move through different phases of this. What, the stress, right? I'm sure there was stress a lot because you're up against things that you certainly didn't realize or new things that you had to do. So how did you release stress? How did you deal with your own emotion, anxiety, whatever words you want to put in there as you maneuvered caregiving?
Well, I'll tell you that there was a lot of stress. Insurance companies posed a lot of stress, just appointments and everything that we had to get to. And I was back to work. I went back to work teaching in May of 05. So I was juggling my job and then getting home and taking care of David and then everything else. So, I mean, at work, on my lunch hour, it was all the calls to the insurance companies trying to get bills settled. So it was incredible amount of stress and anxiety. Now, how did I deal with it? I didn't. I don't think I really did. I think I often say to tell people that I was like the Energizer ostrich. So if you remember the Energizer bunny, they just yes. go. But an ostrich also keeps her head in the sand. And oh. I kind of lived in the moment and did that. Now, being that I just said that, I don't recommend it. At all,
right.
To anybody. It's a horrible way to go through things. And, now whenever I give talks or whenever I do my own radio show, I'm always encouraging caregivers to take some me time, some time just for themselves, even if it's 5 minutes, a cup of tea or a walk around the block, a bubble bath, whatever right. It is. Take some time that you're just doing something for you. Because the other thing is, if you're an airline attendant or if you've ever flown on an airline, you've heard the airline attendant say, put on your own oxygen mask mm-hmm. first and then help others. And it's so true, because if you aren't taking that me time, you are getting totally depleted. But I didn't see it at that time. I didn't see how I could take any time for myself. So, I mean, I was trying to juggle my job and keep on top of that and give everything I could to the kids and then coming home and doing everything that I needed for David. But it's not a very good way to live. So if you can, do some time. Now what I do is I carry around little black polished rock stones, and they're called my me time stones. And I was getting my laundry right the other day, and I dumped out my jeans, and about three rocks, stones fell out of them onto the floor. And it's like, okay, so when I put my hand in a pocket, I put them in jackets all the time too. And it just reminds me, okay, Donnie, you've got to stop for a second, even if it's just, for a cup of tea or whatever. It's not as bad now, Deirdre. It's not, I get
good.
A lot more time to myself. I've joined the theater, and I actually did that in 2005 back in New Jersey.
Oh,
where,
fantastic.
Yeah, so not 2005, I'm sorry, 2010. It was 5 years after David. So if up till that time, I really did not take any time for me. So, but at that point I was able to join the theater and take a little bit of time here and there. Now I can take a whole lot more time because David's much more self-sufficient. He still has a lot of physical disabilities, mm-hmm. but he knows how to work with them.
Well, that's fantastic to hear. I do remember in the book, I think it seemed like in the beginning, it was much more difficult to release emotion. There was, you had shared that there was a family area where families would gather. You even commented sometimes you'd see a doctor come over with either really good news that would make the family very happy or news that would make families incredibly sad, and that you would sort of move yourself away from everybody and you would go sit somewhere and that you were able to cry. And was it not wanting to show anything because it would affect David? I mean, now it seems like emotion, your me time, everything has fallen into place. But was it just so hard in the beginning with emotion to kind of figure it out?
I think what you're talking about is the night we arrived at Columbia Presbyterian. So that meant I had a huge entourage of folks with me, my daughter and David's brothers and some friends, cousins. So there were a lot of people that were there. And I know that that was the first time, well, we went to my house and I got the things. In the shower, I went upstairs, you know, took a shower and I cried there. Then when I was in that waiting room and everybody was over at one area talking and, you know, I moved away. I just had to be alone. I had to, you know, kind of figure out what was going on. And I remember just, you know, curling up on the bench there, I guess it's kind of a bench. It was soft though. And, you know, in crying. And why did I do that? I didn't want my kids to see me devastated or anyone else. I felt, and then when I was ever in the room with David, I always had a happy face because I did not want him to know how bad off everything was. And one of the things David had tells me is that because I was there, he wasn't worried. He said
and you didn't even know that he couldn't communicate.
No, I didn't know that. He told me that much, much later. He said, because you were there, I always knew you were there. Even when he was in a coma, he felt he knew I was there. And he said, I knew that you would be taking care of everything. So I had to always be upbeat. And I was, you know, I was basically David's cheerleader. I wanted him to, you know, win this game. And so that's how I did it. And if I cried or if I was emotional, that was not going to help anybody. So I did it on my time.
You were an incredible cheerleader. Donna, maybe you can just give some parting advice to other people who might be going through traumatic circumstances and they're faced with becoming caregivers. What would you say to them?
Well, some of the things that we just spoke about, and I will reiterate, take care of yourself. You know, I don't have to say that again, but take care of yourself. Take some me time. That's so important. Pick up a stone. I mean, I give them out when I do book signings, but obviously if you're out there listening, we're not going to be in contact. So pick up a stone, any stone, but make sure it resonates with you. Really feel for it. Accept help. That's one of the things I didn't do very well either in the beginning. I didn't accept the help. I was grateful for everyone who came to visit and things like that. But if somebody said, do you need anything? I'd say, no, I got it. I can do it. You know, and that's not a very smart thing to do. I was being pretty stoic at the time, but it's not the very smart thing to do. So learn from my mistakes. You know, that's what I can tell people. And if you do have somebody with brain injury, you don't know what their state's going to be. So don't take it personally. I know a lot of friends who have people who are survivors who are angry and they have emotional behaviors, and those come out and they may seem like they're being directed at the caregiver, but they're generally not. This is a frustration and it's an emotional behavior that can't even be contained. I mean, they don't have any control over it. So just, you know, don't take it personally. And when you see someone on the street, don't be afraid of them. They're just people. I have met so many people, brain injured survivors, that, you know, I just don't even, you know, how you usually kind of glance at somebody that's a little different. We all do. I know I did. Well, now I'm amazed that I just go up and sit and talk to people, and they might have a speech impediment, you know, speech problems. They might be, you know, have quirky movements, but it doesn't faze me anymore because I've become so aware of it. And I think that's what people need to do, is become aware of people that are maybe somewhat different from you.
Become aware. Donna, you made so many great points, but excellent advice. Where can people find out more about you and getting a copy of your book?
Well, you can get a copy of my book at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or any IndieBound.com. If you go there, you'll get an indie bookstore in your area. They should be able to get the book if they're not carrying it already. You can find me on my website, DonnaFigurski.com, and please join us and follow me there. You can also find me on Facebook under just if Donna O'Donnell Figurski and then dash author. That'll take you. So once you get onto Facebook, just go there. Twitter is just Donna Figurski. Instagram is DMODFIGS. And LinkedIn is just go to LinkedIn and put my name in. You'll find it, Donna O'Donnell Figurski, and Pinterest, and same thing. Frankly, Deirdre, if anyone puts my name in, either Donna O'Donnell Figurski or Donna Figurski, they're going to find more than they ever wanted to know about me.
That's fantastic. I'm glad we can find you, Donna. Thank you so much for sharing your story with David and giving many people, all of you Women Worldwide listeners out there, hope, inspiration. Donna, your story will really help others. So we're just so grateful for your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Deirdre. I really appreciate being on the show and so nice to have met you.
Oh, thank you. And so nice to have met you. We'll have to keep this conversation going. And I also want to thank all of the Women Worldwide listeners. Thank you for tuning in every single week. You're the reason that we're growing. And we even have a waiting list of guests now.
Oh, wow.
Moving into 2020. I can't even believe it. So thank you so much, all of you, for your feedback, for sharing. Please keep it coming. We love knowing that you're learning from our guests like Donna, who are making a difference because they're sharing their stories. And don't forget, if you want Women Worldwide updates, you can sign up on the Women Worldwide website at womenworldwideshow.com. So friends, until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.